Okay, all flight controllers, go, no go for landing. Retro.
Go,
I
don't go.
Titan, go.
GNC,
go.
Econ,
go.
Control,
go.
Ninth Planet Audio.
Capcom, we're go for landing.
This is the Turek Books podcast. We're joined today. I'm very excited to bring on Akilah Hughes, who is a writer, comedian, and podcast host.
Yes.
And she is bringing in her books today. And
yeah.
How you doing?
I'm so good. I'm so glad you asked me to do this. We've been trying to figure out a way to hang out. I'm like a major fan of your books, posts online. You go to the libraries around LA and I don't know. I've been a fan for a minute, but I also am a big reader. And so I was like, great.
Yeah, great.
Usually I go on podcasts that don't have a theme and you just kind of ramble and I'm like, wow, I can actually like prepare a little bit.
I know. These are like such a like a safety anchor. You're like,
totally.
Oh, I'm excited to talk about books. I'm not always excited to talk about myself.
Totally. Same.
Nor do I feel people are excited to hear about me. So, but we are excited to hear about you and your books. And like, yeah, you say you're a big reader. Has it always been that way? Have you been reading since you were a kid?
Well, yeah, definitely. I mean, so my mom worked at an elementary school in Kentucky, and she wasn't an educator. She worked, you know, in the Family Resource Center getting resources for people. But because of that, I think she it was also the 90s. So for several reasons, she was always really big into reading. And like the reason I bring up the 90s is because I asked her once, I'm like, do you feel like you did a lot less work back in the day because you didn't have email? And she's like, yeah, sometimes I'd send something out in the mail and then I would sit and read a book and wait for someone to write back. And so I was like, wow, imagine if you just had like 3 days at work to read a book because nothing was happening.
Yeah.
And so she was always reading. She was a big speed reader too, but she was like, she loved education. Like I was reading books starting at like 3, like she was just like forcing them on us. So I loved it then. And then I kind of fell out of love with reading in high school. I felt like the books that were required to read, I just wasn't into, and they weren't for me. And like, you know, some of the classics were good, but some of them, like, how's this a classic? Like, yeah. It's just kind of, it felt like torture. And it wasn't until college when I had an internship where I kind of had that same thing where you could just wait a while for somebody to tell you something to do. And I would just read all day at work. And I realized, I'm like, oh, books are like anything else. You find what interests you and then you just kind of get lost in it. Yeah. And since then, it's been pretty much nonstop. My house is overflowing with books. And I think, you know, as much as I feel like a hoarder sometimes, I'm like, sometimes I want to go back and read one chapter of a specific book.
Yeah.
So I got to keep them.
And if you're going to hoard, like, what better?
Right.
Like books, and I don't mean this in a capitalist way, but maybe I do. They make me feel rich.
Yeah. No, totally.
Like, I get to have a lot of these. These are like my favorite things.
And they're high quality.
And they're high quality. And they're colorful. They actually are appealing to look at.
Yeah, totally.
So yeah, I mean, to me, they're decorative, but like the actual substance to them, it's like I can't believe I can get these for like a dollar at a library.
It's really
library,
yeah, it's pretty shocking. Yeah.
Well, that's really cool. Have you ever revisited a book you hated in high school? Or because I was the same way. Tuned out. I tuned out. I was a bad student. I liked reading, not what we were reading.
Yeah, totally.
But did you ever pick up anything after high school? And like, I picked up The Great Gatsby.
That's what I was going to say. I'm not even kidding. In high school, I remember reading it for the test. Because
right.
It's like, why are you being quizzed on who did what in the story?
That's
like, that's
right.
That doesn't help you care about what it means, especially in relation to, like, capitalism and what it means to like gain money but not the respect of old money.
They're like, just like training us for like the Real Housewives. They're like, you gotta know who Daisy's sleeping with. So
exactly.
That you're
exactly. And like, you know, one day Leonardo DiCaprio will be in it, so you'll have to know who that character is. But yeah, I mean, specifically that book, I remember revisiting it sort of in my Tumblr era of like 2013.
Yeah.
And just thinking, like, I remember this being a book that felt imaginative. It was also probably around when The Great Gatsby film came out, and I was like,
right.
I just kind of want to remember what this was about. And I then went on like a huge F. Scott Fitzgerald thing, which then turned me into what is his wife's name?
Zelda,
yes. Which was great because once I started reading some of her writing, it's like there was an Amazon show called like Z, The Beginning of Everything, I think. And so it was like, it's funny because I think like visual media caught up to those books.
Yeah.
So it kind of made it even more enriching to read it. But totally, like, that was the book, that was the main book I revisited. I tried to get into Crime and Punishment. It's just so long.
It's painful.
I'm like, a synopsis actually is great.
It's painful. Well, and that's actually just to why I brought Anna Karenina.
Yeah.
Because Russian books like Crime and Punishment, and by no means have I read the whole spectrum of Russian books, but,
right,
you know, the ones that make it through,
mm-hmm,
they're really heavy and, like, dense and,
yeah,
worthwhile because they're really talking to very human themes, but they're hard.
Yeah.
And oftentimes depressing. This, to me, is like a summer read.
Yeah.
And I had always stayed away from it because I thought it was the opposite. But I feel like this is one of the easier, more drama-filled, like,
yeah,
fun. I brought up Real Housewives. I call it, like, Real Housewives of Moscow. It's, like, just affairs and, like, whatever. So I feel horrible talking about my books first.
No, don't.
Okay, good. Don't.
I'm always interested.
Check.
As a reader, I'm sure the listeners of this podcast will agree that, like, you're always wondering what other people are reading.
Yeah.
Like, I know what I'm reading is interesting, but I'm also like, what do you read? What's going on?
That question, what are you reading? It opens up so much opportunity to talk. And that's, to me, is also why I want to do the podcast this way, because you're not going to get around to reading every book you want, but,
right,
if someone tells you about it, you do experience it.
Totally.
In a way. And if you're really intrigued, you go and read it. I finally got around to this last year. That's why I brought it in, and yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, Crime and Punishment puts you
tough
in a dark place.
I'll also say I took AP English my senior year of high school, and we had a summer assignment before that year, and one of the books we had to read was Crime and Punishment, and I remember just like painstakingly getting through it and having to write an essay about it. And then when we got to school, no one else had done the summer assignment, and so then I was like, I'm done for the year.
Yeah.
Like, I can't believe that no one's in trouble. Not that I'm like, you know, excited about Crime and Punishment, but it's just like,
that is not a summer read. That's a dead
right, I'm
dead,
like,
winter read.
This is like, you're in trouble and you're in your room.
That's right.
And you just have to think about it and think about what life means and wish for death. And I'm like, oh, no one else did that this summer? Interesting. Interesting.
Well,
choice.
Good preparation for adulthood, I
yeah,
guess.
Totally. I'm like, oh, everything's kind of optional is what I learned.
Yeah. So what did you bring in? I'm really interested in
totally
why you brought what you brought and so forth.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, for the listeners, the light assignment was like, bring 3 or 4 books and just like, you know, why you like them, why you want to talk about them. And that felt very daunting. Not that it is like a big task, but I had to like really think about the books that have impacted me. And also like in the moment we're currently in, I think just the world, it's kind of depressing and there's a lot of inequality.
Yeah.
And so the first book I brought is James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time. I'm a big fan of James Baldwin. I think everybody
yeah.
is, like, especially as you become a reader and like for fun. His writing style is really unique. It feels like conversational, but also biting. Like so this book, of all of his work, I mean, yeah, the description, the review from the New York Times was searing, brilliant, and masterful. This is my second copy because my last copy, all of the books that I read a lot just get super dinged up. Like they're on the side of the bed. I drop water on it, whatever. And it kind of got ruined, but I bought it again, which I usually, you know, I either do or don't.
Yeah,
I'm like, well,
yeah.
It's ruined and that's fine and I'll just buy it if I need it. But this was one that I wanted to keep forever, mostly because I think the way he talks about race in America is probably the most incendiary he ever does. And being a person who's black, a woman on the internet, you know, I think that it's never explicitly said, but always implied, like, you know, I'm a person who kind of goes from gig to gig. And so I have to sometimes tamper exactly what I'm trying to say down to be like palatable for like white audiences, frankly. I mean, it's America. There's more white people than any other kind of people here. And so, you know, I remember in 2020 when a lot of people became more outspoken, myself included. I was hosting a daily news podcast and it was like the main moment of Black Lives Matter. And reading James Baldwin felt so freeing because I was like, oh, this is a thing I can't say on a podcast to like a largely white audience, frankly, which is like, I think, you know, look at why we're here and why we have the assumptions we have about each other. And like in much more damning language than that. Like there was a segment of this book where he just talks about how like white people have to learn empathy in a way that other people don't, because they get to grow up as themselves and they're not always like tamping themselves down. And I think that that's like a hard pill to swallow. If somebody said that to me, I'd be like, what? You think I don't have empathy? Like, yeah. Obviously that's not an easy thing to hear. And obviously it's not true for everyone. And he wrote this in a, I think, a worse time for people of color in the country. Like, we're not in the best moment at the moment, but obviously, you know, in segregated times, and then when things are integrated, but not quickly and not excitedly, you know, a lot of people are doing it reluctantly. He's talking about these things, and I believe this is also, and you know, we can do a correction, but I think by this point he's expatriated. He lives in France. Yes. And so he kind of has this hindsight view of America that felt like, I mean, I think all millennials think about expatriating because of the student debt. You know what I mean? Like,
the amount of times in my household.
Every time I've ever left the country, I taught, like, I find Americans there who've expatriated, and they're like, it's the best decision I ever made.
Wow.
Can't come back, but I don't miss it. I'm like, ooh, hard to hear. I mean, really just, and so it's like to hear his sort of vision of America at that time. And I think, I don't think this is his last writing, but it's like, he obviously, I think it's softer in his older age, but this is probably the most angry James Baldwin ever is. And I think that, like, as women, I think that, like, we're told to not show anger, especially black women. Like, that's the one emotion that gets you canceled. And so, like, to just have this as an outlet to, like, be like, okay, actually, somebody did say it one time, and it got published, and it's still in print.
Somebody did say it one time.
Yeah, like, wow, you know, and, like, he did have to leave the country, to be fair.
Yeah.
But I think this book, it just feels like maybe the freest I think an angry black person is ever allowed to be.
Okay, so he articulates the rage.
Totally.
And there's a catharsis in reading it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's...
And an empowerment, it sounds like, right?
Fully.
Like, you put it into words, and now I get to kind of own it.
Yeah, and it's funny that you say that. I mean, not funny, but, like, it makes me think a lot about the fact that he said it back then. One thing that I've talked about with my mother plenty of times is, like, about race relations in America, but specifically, like, did they have it worse? You know, what did it look like? And I remember once my mom said something that, like, will stay with me forever, which was, like, well, it might be a little bit worse now. And I was not on the side of that. I was like, can you explain it? And she was like, well, think about it. We marched for the same thing you're marching for, so it's, like, that's not different. But also, like, your grandmother could go home and not look at her phone and be called a slur.
Right.
Like, it wasn't all day, every day. Right. There was, you know, like, if you're segregated out, then you're not facing racism all the time. Like, there really was a world where if you just stayed on certain blocks, you got to be a person without the lens of, you know, just having to see yourself through whiteness. And I think that that's something that, like, is hard to parse, because I've call myself an internet person, and when we get to my book, I'll talk a little bit more about that. But I think it's tough, because there was a time when the internet was a subculture where there were segments where you could go find yourself and be free, and now it's kind of like a high school cafeteria where everybody's there.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh great, more of this.
Yeah, and the food's not that good,
right? Sucks. Sucks. And isn't good for
did
you
did you see that tweet going around? It was like, we used to go on the internet to escape our lives, now we go to our lives to escape.
Yes,
the internet.
And it's so real. Like, my prediction for the future was always that, you know, people would get tired of this and, like, just be able to go off. But what's unfortunate is, I think that our economy has become so surrounded by the internet.
Yes.
That, like, I think about my own ambitions in media, and how as a kid when I was in college, right, and I was starting a YouTube channel when, like, no one was making money on YouTube, and thinking, like, if I can just have a good enough portfolio, then I'll never have to be here again. And now it's like, yeah, you will.
Yeah, no, that's weird. That's like where,
like, J-Lo's here now, actually. Oof, so now you're stuck.
They're going back into the pit.
Yeah. It's like you can just never get out.
No.
It's like the Dark Knight Rises, but they don't come out of that cave. It's just weird and dark down there.
Yeah, and who knows how much of our behavior is just being steered by it.
Totally.
Like, these like, am I thinking these thoughts, or am I being told to feed these thoughts?
Totally.
Now? And
what would I care about if the internet wasn't that big of a part of my life for so long at this point?
At this point, yeah. And it's really tough to parse
right?
out.
Totally.
Because it's like, I liken it to, like, a casino.
Mm-hmm.
where there is a casino of information and opportunity, and that's all there, but like you're betting your mind
totally
and your soul to the, and what happens to people in casinos, usually they lose.
Yeah.
So yeah, you're losing kind of a significant part of your experience as a human being. But yeah, then like, hey, we're meeting now.
Exactly, because of the internet.
Because of the internet.
And honestly, the only reason anybody would have me on a podcast is because I built all of this stuff on the internet. I always say it's like this democratizing force. Like, okay, everybody gets a voice. But then you look at democracy and it's like, well,
yeah,
not everybody needs the loudest megaphone. Some people could just like whisper their thoughts or keep them to themselves. Now it's our job to sift through all of it.
Sift through all of it. And that, so you were talking earlier about what your mom said, and it's like, yeah, we are carrying around the world's cries in our pocket and in mm-hmm. our hands. Every day the world is screaming at us.
Yeah.
And we're not biologically equipped to hear that. And so it is like psychically draining. And then speaking to race relations, it's like, yeah, there's just so much ugliness. And also I got to imagine like passive aggression.
Totally.
Which is like the gaslighting quality of things.
Right.
It's like, all right, we want to build an equal society where we're all getting exploited by corporations.
Right. Like, let me just have the same chance to have all my crap stolen from me.
it's
all we want.
But yeah, it's real, and I was just entranced, absorbed listening to you talk about all that with that. It's so cool that a book could sort of connect you to the moment, and a book written decades before.
Totally.
Right? And so it's like the more things change, the more they stay the same in some ways,
yeah.
And then even if the context changes or improves or gets worse, it's like a lot of those human feelings are still there and felt.
Definitely. I mean, and I guess the last thing I would say about this book is like, it's also really helpful when you see people take quotes from James Baldwin and apply them to situations now, and it's like the smallest vision of who he was and
right.
what he had to say.
Right.
And it's often people who would never read this book in particular.
Right.
Like the first time he would say white people, they'd be like, ah.
Yeah, that's right.
What do you mean he saw race? And I'm like, he did. Like, he lived it.
The way it gets so palatable. I mean, we just had like Martin Luther King Day, and
yeah.
everyone on the internet goes, hey, like, so you know, Martin Luther King was like very anti-war, anti-capitalist.
Yeah.
Like, so these politicians who are saying this, it's like, hey, you're not.
Yeah, you're not like, you're not even espousing the reality of what he cared about. It's like, but it's also the funny thing where when I grew up in Kentucky, you know, like people would say as if he was Jesus, he died for racism. Like he died. I'm like, he was murdered. He got
yeah.
shot.
Yeah.
People like Ted Cruz would have killed him. And because
yeah.
he's a serial killer, right? The Zodiac killer. Am I allowed to say that? They're cutting it all. But in any case, I just don't think that like, you know, obviously Mitch McConnell, who stands in front of Confederate flags, isn't a real fan of what Martin Luther King stood
right.
for.
Right.
If he could never say, like, just Black Lives Matter, like, that seems like the baseline, and that's just never going to come out of his mouth.
Right.
So it's just weird. I mean, I think that he's an interesting avatar. So that's my first book.
You know what? Actually, like, in response to that, so during, right around that time, I was like, I got to get into more Black authors. I feel like Paul Beatty is a perfect counter to the conversation. He's like bizarro James Baldwin.
Oh, wonderful.
Have you read any of
no,
them?
No, please tell me about
so
this.
So he's just like so weird, and he's very micro LA
yeah.
at times, and he's so funny, but he's biting.
Yeah.
He's sharp, and he uses like a lot of absurdity to drive home messages about race in America and in the world. And he's the kind of author, and I've said it on the internet, like I greedily wish he had even more books.
Yeah.
Because like I just like want more of his books. This one, Slumberland, is my favorite. It's probably the most fun of his, but it's basically like this Black avant-garde DJ in LA who's like very much into like capturing a little noise from the freeway, a little
yeah.
noise from a baby crying, and building these songs. He goes to seek out his hero in Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get like that Cold War Berlin
oh, wow,
element
yeah.
and just the sort of absurdity of the human folly and European culture. And
oh, I love it.
Yeah, I can't, you know, so.
I don't know much about Cold War Germany, I'll be honest.
Yeah, I don't
so,
either.
Like, well,
I don't either.
Well, I would just say, though, that, like, it's fascinating to, like, have the juxtaposition of somebody who's, like, Black LA and, like, so, like, grounded in that to be put in an era that I obviously would imagine, like, it was called the Cold War because it was not
yeah.
for a reason, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, I don't know. I love books like that. I think it also just helps, I think, characterize those timelines in a way that I think I wouldn't necessarily be that interested in otherwise.
Yeah, I went to Berlin and I just did a bunch of ketamine, so I don't know the history either.
Yeah, the K holds, yeah, it was, yeah, exactly this. You actually dreamed this book.
With my arm around a lamppost and was like, this is not good.
That's what I hear about Berlin, of all the places in Germany. It's, yeah, also, I've been thinking about Germany a lot lately, which is a very vague thing to say, but only insofar as my New Year's resolution has already been achieved. I learned how to sing 99 Luftballons,
okay,
in German, yeah, and I was like, I've never spoken a word of German. I took French in school. It just wasn't a culture that I was even remotely familiar with, and now I'm like watching a bunch of German music videos because I'm like, it's just cool to sing in that language.
Yeah, so the song comes on, you got it down.
Yeah,
you,
yeah,
can do it at karaoke.
Yeah, I did it at karaoke.
Okay, how'd it go?
It went pretty well. There were some parts where, like, I posted one small clip on the internet and I did get corrected. Apparently it's 9 and 9 zig Luftballons.
Okay.
I'm
now
like, cool, man.
Hairs.
Like, it's also, when you're doing karaoke, sometimes you do end up reading it because you don't want to get lost.
Yeah, that's,
and so,
right,
I'm going to read it in my American accent.
Yeah.
And I mess it up, but the beats were right. And that's what matters.
That's amazing. Good for you.
Thank you so,
yeah,
much.
Yeah, and what an intoxicating song to learn. It's so catchy. I can hear it in my head.
Right. Yeah. And it's like, I mean, I guess, I don't know if it's a song about the Cold War,
yeah,
but it's about
it
war.
Yeah, what's it about anyway?
It's a song about a child with a red balloon that releases it in the air, and then all of the world's superpowers mistake it for a rocket, and so then we all explode each other because we can't take the, like, innocence of just, like, something in the sky. Like, we're all that tense,
no,
and scared.
Way.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, the last lines in English are like, something about, like, in this dust that was a city, if I could find a souvenir just to prove the world was here, and here's a red balloon, I think of you and let it go. Gorgeous, right?
Jeez Louise, that is gorgeous.
But it's, you know, it's also like, ugh, the proliferation of war. It's,
I
in
know,
everything.
It's in everything. Wow, what a, yeah. Who knew?
Who knew? This is, I knew I wanted to talk to you because I'm like, you'll get it.
Yeah.
My brain's going to go everywhere, but it's always jogged by books. I think that, like, that's the inspiration.
I agree. And, like, the way they help us locate ourselves.
Yeah.
The conversations that spawn just from books and the subject matter and the intimacy of reading it, it, like, I think it swells up. And so, like, you even, the introverted type, they do want to talk it out.
Totally.
Because it lives there. So, yeah, that's, I'm with it. I'm with it, and I already learned something really cool about a song that I thought was just, like, featured in a couple very,
right,
fun 90s movies.
Exactly. It always feels like it's just, like, very chill. But, like, I obviously heard the English version first and in college, and I remember being like, what? Like, at the beginning of Google, I was like, what is this song about? And then I was just like, oh, wow, deep. Painful. Mm. Well, another book.
Yeah, what else do you have going on here?
So this book, I think, will be right up your alley. It's called Debt, The First 5,000 Years by David Graeber.
Okay, I'm in already.
Yeah, totally.
It is up my alley. I got Debt.
Yeah, so this book changed my life. I read this book a year ago, right before the strikes in Hollywood, before I think a lot of, at least for millennials who are working in sort of new media, and, like, even if you're in journalism, whatever, there's just this sort of shuttering of a lot of things right now. And it felt reminiscent of the recession in, like, 2010, where, you know, I'm graduating from college, there's supposed to be this opportunity waiting, and there's nothing. And it's like, we'll just go figure it out. And you just kind of can't. You know what,
yeah,
I mean? Like, there's no way to get past, like, you can't save enough money if you're not making enough money.
That's
it's
right.
Just impossible. And so I was playing Mario Kart with a few friends, as you do. We
as
were on
did.
Zoom, and my friend Grace Harvey, she lives in Michigan, was playing, and we kind of took a break and we're just talking, and I was like, what's everybody reading? And she mentioned this book. And the synopsis I would give is that it has this alleviating effect about debt, because it makes a really important point that I think people need to hear over and over and over again, which is that debt is older than money. It is not at all a moral thing. It has nothing to do with your value, because, like, capital has nothing to do with your value. It's like maybe your value in relation to capitalism, but not necessarily about, like, what your life means. And so when it says like the first 5,000 years, it's like, you know, going all the way back to sort of feudalism and like that sort of era where it's like, yeah, you might work the land to get some food and have to keep doing that. And, you know, whatever that looks like, or someone saves your family from, I don't know, proliferation. And so then like forever you're in their debt. The idea of it being that like, you know, now we live in a time where everyone's expected to make enough money to survive. And like, I think this book came out obviously a while ago. They keep updating it, so I'm like probably need a new copy. But reading it in the past just few years, I keep coming back to us being millennials, but I'm like, we're a unique generation. Like, I once tried to sell a project that I thought would be called like On the Decade, because I'm like, it seems like every decade some terrible thing happens that is like, it reshapes the entire world. It's like we went from 9/11 to the recession to COVID. It's like we're just bouncing through atrocity. And the idea that like you would somehow just be able to hold on to money without like experiencing life is suffocating. And this book really finally made me feel like, you know what, there are going to be moments in my life forever, right? Like, I don't come from money. So like, if there's, you know, an emergency, I might be back in that place.
Yeah.
But to just know that like, as old as debt is, like getting out of it and like having a life is also a thing, or like just not letting it be a cloud. Like, I think, yes. You know, I get these ads on Instagram that are like, you got to take care of your debt. This is the year that you like pay down your credit cards. And it's like this sort of end goal. And I'm like, okay. And then you get to $0 owed to anybody. And then eventually something happens, or, you know, maybe you win the lottery, and that could be anything, like getting a dream job, or, you know, somebody dies and leaves you a bunch of money that you didn't know about, or you get a scholarship, whatever. But I think the stress that we live under of like always having to be trying to bury that is wasteful. It's just a waste of energy. Like, you know, I'm not saying go into debt on purpose, but I'm saying like, don't let it reflect on your days. And like, if you get a notification from, I don't know, Chase Bank, Capital One on your phone that says like you're in the negative, like there, you have to unlearn, I think, a lot of that. Like, well, this, what does this say about me? I'm a bad person.
Yes, and you were saying it's not like a like debt is before money, and it's not a reflection of your own value. Like what you're saying, it's almost like it's an energetic exchange of nature.
Yes,
right?
Totally.
And it's like a natural movement and a. In cooperating forces, there's going to be imbalances.
Totally.
And they're going to maybe find balance. Maybe they're going to just like keep slipping in one direction or another.
Yeah.
And that's because something has something and something doesn't.
Right.
Thinking like energetically or someone. Or,
right.
But yeah, that is so interesting. It's not a reflection of us.
Yeah. It's just not. And I think too, like we're just in such a, I mean, obviously America is the capital C capitalist society, right? But it's like, I think especially with the internet, now you have to be able to show it to people. And like, I remember growing up broke in Kentucky, like just being able to like paint your bedroom was like, felt like a luxury.
Yeah.
And now it's like, well, now it has to be an aesthetic that people appreciate.
Right.
And I know I've bought into it. Like, I love interior design. I subscribed to Architectural Digest. I could have brought a stack of those magazines. So it's like, I'm not immune. But I also know that, like, ultimately, that is just, like, an expression of who you are, but not necessarily, like, an expression of your value.
Yes.
Like, and you have to separate yourself. And I think that I'm always trying to, like, actively do that. Like, if I have a lesson in my life, it's, like, stop. And maybe it's everybody, but it's, like, you are more than the awards you're given. You're more than the applause you're given. You're more than what you can show to the world. You have an interior life for a reason. And so, like, I felt like this book was a revelation. I think about it all the time. I think about it every time I pay a bill.
Wow. We were getting Architectural Digest for a while, and I said, like, a millennial getting Architectural Digest is like a prisoner getting Playboy.
It is.
Like, all right, this is what I yearn for,
it's
but
true.
May not ever touch.
And you know what else? It's like, it's funny that you would compare it to that for so many reasons, but it's like, I think there's a lot of shame around pornography, and I'm like, I kind of feel the same shame about having AD in my house, where I'm like, oh, wow, yeah, like, I mean, I shouldn't be looking at this.
This is wrong.
Exactly. I hope this people don't wrong. Think I want a house.
Like, yeah, no,
yeah.
Not a house.
And then I do resent it. I'm like, why do you get to have that?
The thing is, though, like, thinking about like, they were saying in the 50s, Americans didn't really have much debt,
right.
And now we do. But, like, thinking back to the conversation you had with your mom, like you didn't have a shopping mall in your hand right. all day long too right. that learns you.
Exactly.
It's like, what the fuck? Right. We're supposed to battle the forces of machinery that's learned our every tendency mm-hmm. as consumers, as behavior, like just behavior models, and then be like, yeah, and I'm not an, like I'm being austere with my money.
Totally.
That, it's a difficult thing when you're like a lab rat
yeah,
all day
I mean,
long,
fully.
Every day.
And like, you know, even as study after study comes out to tell us that like social media is not good for us, it's like changing our brains and it's like kind of unregulated, like there's just more and more and more of it. And so like I know that I have like actively, I'm on TikTok a little bit, but like it's the one social network that I have like, I really am not addicted to yet.
Yeah.
And I say yet because I'm like, one day there'll be the one thing, you know, and I'll just have enough time. Like I'll break a hand and then just be like, well, all I have to do all day is scroll. But like, it's funny that no matter what the platform is, whatever it is on our phone always turns to sales. No
That's
matter
right.
what, in the end, they're going to try to sell you something.
That's right.
And I'm like, okay, so then if everything on my phone is advertising, even the art, even the things that I think are, you know, opening, like if I'm always going to be threatened by someone showing up to like sell me something, like it does require a level of like, I think just backing up and being alone and reflecting on like, what do I need? Like when you talk about the 50s, I understand why some people are romanticizing.
No, I'm not romanticizing.
No, I'm not even saying that you do. I just think that like, I understand the idea, like, I, in the way that I romanticized the 90s because I wasn't on my phone all day, you know?
Right.
Like, there was just one less thing nagging at me. But I think, like, to that point, you know, there AD, I'm sure, existed in the 50s, and, like, there's Vogue and whatever else, like, these old things. But it always felt so far out from people's regular
right.
lives. And now it's, like, people who look like you, who have sort of, like, seemingly regular lives, are online, and now they have this crazy house that has, like, these specific kind of curtains, and it's like, well, does it block out the light? Like, what happened to utility? Like, it's just funny because I think, you know, even as the world becomes more aesthetically pleasing, I guess, you know, like, and the algorithms have figured out what we will react to, it's all still kind of unnecessary. Like, at
yeah.
the end of the day, as long as I have a roof, some food, water, and, like, you know, the ability to take care of myself, I feel like that's enough, but... You know, AD would tell me that I was just destitute and terrible.
Yeah, exactly. They should do like AD for broke people, you know, Architectural Digest for broke people. And it's like, here's what so-and-so did with their apartment.
They try to
that
do it with apartment
with...
therapy.
Oh, they
and
do
like,
try.
But even then,
right?
There's one episode, and I watch every home tour video that's on the internet. Like, I'm addicted, truly. It's like part of my morning routine is to find any kind of home tour. And it's like there are some where I'm like, oh, they're just not disclosing that their family's wealthy, and that pisses
That's
me
right.
off so deeply.
That's right.
Oh, they're like, I'm 32. I have this huge church we bought and put a trampoline in, and I'm like, I
yeah.
actually can't interact with this.
Yeah, show us the receipts.
Right. I'm like, and what do you
Who
do?
Co-signed?
You're a photographer. I'm not that good of a photographer. That's interesting.
And so just to finish up with the debt book, like what was the – like you say it made you feel better.
Yeah.
And like, so what was like the central message that debt is just a part of things and you're like, we're.
I think it was like really harping on the morality of debt because
the morality
like now I think that that's actually very new. Like, truly. I mean, obviously, like with slavery and indentured servants and that sort of thing, like it gets hairy. But like, specifically now, like I would say from the 50s till now, there has been a real push, and maybe that's because women got credit cards. And so it was like, let's punish people for having debt, right? Or like see it as a flaw. But it's like, there's an entire industry about not only getting money however you can, like the credit system in this country, in the world, it just gives me hives. But like the idea that you should just borrow money for the sake of it. And then like, if you pay it off, you somehow owe more, or your score goes down.
Your score
down.
Goes down, yeah.
All of that science is bullshit. But it is the backing of our society now. And, like, you know, I think between that and then, like, God, the conversations about the debt ceiling that America has. When
right.
We all know that it has no effect on our day-to-day lives. Like,
right.
It just doesn't. It's just sort of a thing like, well, we're just this far in debt. I'm like, but no one's calling it in because we have all the bombs. So I guess it's not a problem. And I'm like, well, then... You know, like if you applied that to the individual, that would be much different.
Yeah.
But they would never give us that sort of benefit. And so I think like it just takes this weight of like having to think that like, you know, there's so many people selling you something on Instagram to be like, I don't have any debt. Look at my life. I'm so wonderful.
Right.
Look what I was able to pay off. And it's like, being able to pay something off should not be a thought on your deathbed.
Yeah, and that's
that,
right.
That was enough for me. Like, I just needed someone smarter to me than me to write it down.
So my debt is not a me problem.
Right. Yeah. It just isn't. It just isn't.
I actually feel better hearing that. Because I got out of debt recently, and then, like, real quickly.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. And I just think, like...
But it was, like, everything it took to get out of debt put me back into debt. Because I was, like, neglecting things just to get out of debt. And then it was like, all right, well, I guess I'm going to have to go into debt to fix this.
And even just thinking about it is, like, so much brain space. Like, you know, I don't feel like I'm doing great financially right now. And I'm, like, fine to say that. Like, we just had 8 months where basically no one got paid. Like,
yeah.
It's just really tough in L.A. right now. And I think that, like, because things seem to be happening in my career, but, like, the money doesn't necessarily reflect it, you know, it becomes this feeling of, like, what am I doing wrong? And it's like, what if it's not something that you're doing wrong? What if it's just, like, the state of the world at this moment?
Yeah.
What if, like, you could just think about, you know, the creative things that have always helped your life and made you feel better and made you feel useful and interesting and, you know, made you want to write? Like, you know, instead of thinking about, like, well, I don't have what this person has. And, yeah, I think that that's just, it's great to have this. I think everyone should have this book on their shelf.
I love it. Yeah, I'm putting it on my list for sure.
Excellent.
Yeah. yeah, and, like, just these ideas of, why we're doing what we're doing, like, independent of the marketplace.
Yeah.
And then, like, as the marketplace continues to, like, almost eat itself and get more and more absurd, it does also make it easier to see why you do what you do independent of that.
Totally.
Like, yeah, I just love telling stories, or I love making people laugh, or, you know.
Totally.
Well, I love attention, whatever it
yeah,
is.
Yeah, whatever
my parents didn't look at me enough, so now I love it. Whatever it is, but
right.
It's like, yeah, it does kind of, like, clarify why you do what you do if you're not getting rewarded for it.
Right.
I always say people who, like, are the worst at things kind of love them the most.
Yeah.
Because they're not getting gratified even by like, even if you're a tennis player and you're horrible, but you play every day, it's like you don't even get to feel the beauty of a nice shot, but you
right.
still are, you must love it
right.
to keep
exactly.
doing it.
Exactly. Yeah. And, like, it's how I know I do truly love interior design, is that, like, every time I'm broke, the first thing I want to do is, like, make the things in my house look nice.
Yeah.
Not with money, but literally just, like, what if I rearrange this? What if I painted this room all day, and then, like, the zen nature of just getting the paint perfect is, like, enough for me to not think about other stuff and be on my phone? Like, I really do think that, like, and it's, like, obviously my stuff's not, like, AD, but, like...
No, but just tending to your space
definitely.
Is something you love to do, and it's like, well, yeah, this is what you're inhabiting every day,
yeah.
So how cool to have that presence.
Totally. Totally. It's
nice.
Like something about being organized. It's the same feeling of, like, in you know, there's plenty of things that'll shame people into doing whatever. Like, I think there is a world where they're like, buy a bunch of clear things so that your house looks organized. But nice. I like being able to come up with a system for my life. I'll be brief on this one. I love this book. It's called Someone Who Will Love You and All Your Damaged Glory by Raphael Bob Waksberg. He created BoJack Horseman. I rewatch that show often. I'm a big rewatcher. But that show I find to be profound. And, like, also just maybe my first time watching adult animation that wasn't, like, The Simpsons, where I was like, oh, like, you can, like, this medium is actually bigger than,
right.
like, if it's, like, you know, in real life. Like, they can do things that are impossible and tell stories in a way that are disarming because it's like a rabbit. but so I picked up this book because I love the show. And I think this is his first book. And what I loved about this book, and I think it informs the way I think about every project that I do now, is that he seemed to, before, I guess, any other book that I've read, like, I see it, I think I recognize it more now, but what he does is tell stories the way they need to be told, which sounds insane. So let me, like, break it down. Like, to describe, there's a short story in here, and it's basically essays, but there's a short story in here that's a series of limericks. And it's about a guy who loves this woman, and she finds him annoying. And the limericks get more and more annoying till you understand why she doesn't like him. But he's so desperate in these limericks, and I'm like, I think that there's something really cool about... I mean, it would take me a long time to figure out how to tell, you know, one specific story in that way, but it's very clever. And I think that, like, it informs the way I try to do comedy. Like, I do sketch comedy, and I once sold a show to a big network, and then the strike. And so it's like there was just a lot to talk about. And one of the things, so the cover of this book is George Washington, like a sort of weird, it's like real hands, but the face is kind of like porcelain. And one of the sketches that we wrote for Disney, one of the sketches we wrote was about the founding fathers, but we told the story through like a reality show, like the real founding fathers of DC, and they're like these 20-year-old fuckboys, because they were, and it's sort of like their intention versus how people are using it now. So they have to go to like, you know, the Bravo set and talk about how the news is saying they want all these shootings to happen, and they're like, that's not our intention. Like, we don't know. And I felt like I wasn't able to do that always. Like, I would have ideas, but I couldn't figure out the right medium to tell them in. And he just really is excellent at it.
So you drew like creative inspiration from it. You feel like reading him and watching his shows has made you a stronger writer.
Yeah, totally.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
That osmosis of inspiration.
Yeah. It's like it makes me want to be better, and then it's like I hold it to this standard.
Right.
So it's like it's a tall order, but I think it's worthwhile. I'm like trying to think. Oh, goodness. Oh, there was this one story that was really good. Just briefly, it was about a guy who's like is on a train in New York City, and there's a woman sitting across from him, and they like kind of make eyes at each other, and he thinks about you know, saying something, but then he just doesn't get off the train, like, and then she doesn't either, and then for like 80 years they ride the train because they're both afraid of what is happening, and then eventually she gets off and he just like has to go home.
That's hilarious.
But it's like this like the anticipation was too great for them to ever act on it, and I'm like, yeah, no, you just like go to the end of the line and just be staring at each other and just keep riding that wave. Yeah, it's just like they're so fun. It's a quick read. The book is aesthetically pleasing. It looks good on the bookshelf.
Yeah, it does.
It feels like the Pixar, Pixar intro to Up. You're like our whole lives, but then you've wasted your whole life. It's so real.
That's cool. Yeah. So he's written a book too. Wow.
Yeah, I know. It's like, don't you have enough?
Yeah, can't you just like settle on one? Wouldn't it just be great to just do one great thing?
Yeah. As you know, I don't think that's allowed anymore.
Leave some for the rest of. Yeah, right?
Yeah, you can't just coast.
There's just not a lot of money in one great thing, right?
It used to be you have one hit song, and it's like, so this is my mansion. You're good. I live in another country. It's like all glass.
Well, you're all into these shows where people are, you know, here's my apartment. Mm-hmm. I remember Cribs on MTV, which was one of the first.
Yes.
And it was like, this is where the music video director Mick G lives. And it's like, this guy literally just directs music videos, and he's like living in a mansion in the Hollywood Hills.
Right.
It's like, and it's like your average budget for a music video now.
Yeah.
No, it's like one's getting paid.
$50.
Yeah, $50.
And you have to have the Beats by Dre speaker in every scene.
That's right.
It's impossible. It's impossible. And it might not even been hit music videos. Just the opportunity was enough for him to be like, and then I paid for everything. And now I'm like, yeah, everyone I know who writes for TV writes for several TV shows.
Right. Yeah, I could go on and on about how
it's unfair.
Well, you were talking about it earlier, and I just didn't want to like go deep into it, how like millennials are unique in the sense that the world we were taught was there, it evaporated before our eyes.
Yeah.
And if you really do the research, the world we were taught that was there wasn't that cool of a world,
right,
anyway.
It wasn't there
but
either.
I remember thinking, okay, I'll be a writer at worst. Maybe I could, you know, I'll write a few articles for magazines along the way. And
totally.
There were people who made a really nice living doing that, and like, no, that does not, there are no
doesn't
magazines
exist.
There are no magazines.
Yeah, I remember like when I first started blogging for like other websites, so this is like 2012-ish, and I remember even thinking like, oh well, if I'm just making this as a side hustle, like I could always still have a job and do this for fun.
Yeah.
And I never accounted for the fact that things would just keep getting more expensive.
Right.
Like I'm like, oh, but the money's not better.
No.
So then I just have to keep doing more work.
More.
And then die younger than my parents.
That's right.
And work till I'm dead. And never have the AD house.
Yeah. No, I mean, if Nikki Haley gets her way, you know.
I know. We'll yeah, exactly. She's like forever.
She's like, yeah, 70's reasonable. It's like, all right.
Yeah, I'm already
like,
70.
everyone just keeps saying the quiet part out loud these days. And it's like, can you just like
pretend I'm not cattle for 5 minutes. Give me like, the illusion.
I understand I'm coal being fed into the furnace, but like, can you not say it so often?
Right. And like without any irony.
Without any irony. Yeah, I know. I know. Say what you want about Trump, but at least he makes his evil funny, right?
Yeah, totally.
Whereas,
yeah.
Like some of these other ones.
They won't even give us that.
No. Okay, and so we're down to the final book, which is your book that you wrote.
This is it.
I want to hear about this.
This is my book.
So you published it how long ago?
This book came out 5 years ago in September of this year.
Wow.
Yeah, it's wild because, okay, so the book's called Obviously Stories from My Timeline. It's a green book, which is funny because I did a bunch of photo shoots for the cover. And it's funny because I didn't want to be on the cover. Like, I actually just don't have many books where somebody's face is on the cover. And I was like, I think people will be more likely to buy it, like, you know, just to get into the nitty-gritty. I started on YouTube, and I've, you know, done a lot with YouTube, like, with the actual, like, corporate part of it. And, yeah, like, people don't click on black people's faces. It's just like, I have friends who are on YouTube who are black, but they're like animators, and they never put themselves in the thumbnail. And they're like, yeah, okay. Every time I've ever been in a thumbnail, it's been the worst performing video. Ugh. So I had that instinct, and they're like, you should just be proud to be on it. I'm like, fine, whatever. You guys have like a 2016 pussy hat version of this in your mind where everyone's going to rally around it. And so we did all these other colorways, and it's like, I think the process of making a book is great because, like, all of these illusions about, like, having any real power in it fade away. Like,
okay.
I didn't get to choose the cover. Like, I didn't want to be on the cover. Then I was on the cover. Then I didn't get to choose the picture. And then, like, this is an amalgamation of several pictures. Like, it's like, we're going to put your face from one pose on your
body. No way.
I'm like, so this is all actually smoke and mirrors on the front. But alas, it's funny that this book came out almost 5 years ago because it took 5 years to write. And I've gone through, like, a bunch of emotions about the book. The synopsis is like, it was my life until that point. So this is a book about from 0 to 26 in my life. And growing up in Kentucky, where, you know, specifically where I was growing up, there wasn't a ton of diversity, and feeling like really educated and wishing there was like more out there. And then like the internet hitting at the exact moment that I graduated from high school, like social media starting with like MySpace. Obviously there were things before that, but like that's the real moment where everything changed. Figuring out that I wanted to make digital media and like specifically on YouTube, and then moving to New York with this big dream of it, and like sort of getting a bunch of stuff that I wanted, but then like having it kind of be put on a major pause because of like serious illness. Like when I turned 26, I felt really bad. Like at night I would be like, I get really hot, and when I roll over my side hurts. And having like, you know, now there are words for like medical gaslighting for like black women, but like at the time they're just like, I don't really think this is a thing. Like they would just kind of, you know, I did an endoscopy, colonoscopy, they're not like seeing anything, so they're like, you're just crazy. I remember at one point I had an ultrasound, and they were like, okay, well, you have like, you know, like maybe some fibroids, but like nothing major. And I was like, should I get like a CAT scan? And they're like, well, no, like this doesn't seem like a big deal. And I'm like, but it's like pretty major. It's like affecting my life. And like it got to a really strange point. Like I was flying out to LA for work, and I got this like insane full body rash and like these heart palpitations that were just nuts. I thought I was having a heart attack. And so I did this like thing with YouTube. I did a panel on stage, and like while everyone is still there, I just walk out, call 911, get in an ambulance, and go to the hospital. And even at the hospital, they were like, well, it's just, if it's a rash, I'm like, it's not just the rash, but they were like, just go home, take aspirin. Like, they didn't care. And then I felt, oh, the whole way back to New York, I was like, I feel like I'm dying. And so, you know, I had this doctor at the ultrasound be like, well, I mean, if you want to pay for it, get a CAT scan, but like, seems like it's nothing. And so I do this CAT scan, and they find a grapefruit-sized tumor, benign, thankfully, on my liver, and then a golf ball-sized tumor, also benign, on my liver. And so, like, it's basically throwing blood clots. So I'm having, like embolisms. And I have all these doctors just being like, no. And so then once they're found, they're like, well, it's a major surgery. And, like, don't you want to have kids? Like, maybe you might not be able to have kids, like, or you could die. And I'm like, I feel like you guys are prioritizing this kid that doesn't exist over, like, the blood
clots. Whoa.
To the point where I started going... It became like a full-time job. I started going to doctors, like surgeons, and basically interviewing them. And if they were like, I'm not doing it, I'm like, okay, bye.
Yeah.
Like, you don't want to talk about any other treatments? I'm like, no. And I finally found this great doctor at Mount Sinai, and he operated. And so it was like this moment where it felt like everything in my career was on an up trajectory. Like, I had a great career in writing at Fusion. I loved all my coworkers. They've all gone on to do incredible things. I got into the Sundance Labs and, like, no one on YouTube was getting up. Like, it was this moment where people did not like online media. Like, if you were there, you were like, that's all you do.
Yeah.
You don't get the crossover.
Yeah.
Like, you're not Justin Bieber.
Yes.
You're trapped. And so, like, to get through to Sundance, like, as a writer, felt like I was getting validation in an industry that I was desperate to break into. I had gotten this book deal. And then everything that I had written in the first 6 months of the book felt so stupid after I got sick. Like, it was like, well, this doesn't matter. Like, life matters, you know, and how long am I going to be alive and, like, fighting for that? And so much of that is in this book. Reading it back now, it's like, I think I have a lot more empathy for myself because this was my first book. And I'm not working on one right now. But, like, I had these high hopes. Like, it'll be a bestseller. It'll do all this stuff. And, like, it took so much longer to write. So, like, it felt like I put so much into it. And, like, that didn't happen. It didn't not sell. It just didn't sell, like, you know, bestseller levels. And I think that, like, it was sort of like if you made a great video and it didn't go viral. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I also realized in that moment that it's, like, it is still playing the lottery.
Yeah.
No matter what. Like, there are so many books and movies that I love that, like, no one gives a shit about. I finally got to a place where I wasn't looking for the outside validation because what I wrote felt so true. And then... like, I guess as a small pivot. So my editor, who I love so much, she wrote me these very thoughtful notes about it when I was like, I can't, you know, meet this deadline. I'm sick, but I'm writing about being sick. So, like, you know, just wait, whatever. She was so wonderful and understanding. And so my book comes out in September of 2019. And a couple of weeks later, she was diagnosed with ovarian cancer. And, you know, it was weird because I was writing about, like, thinking about death. And how when you get a diagnosis that feels, you know, insurmountable, it's like there is this wall between you and the rest of the world where it's like all of those plans you had no longer matter. Like, it's just about surviving the day. And I remember it being, like, really heartening because she was like, it's funny, but, like, your book means a lot more to me now, frankly. I guess, cliff notes are that, like, she passed away a couple of months ago from ovarian cancer. And she has this huge legacy because before she died, she and her husband, so her name was Casey McIntyre, her husband, Andrew Rose Gregory, they came together and decided that they wanted her last sort of legacy to be paying off medical debt. They did a debt jubilee. So debt is a theme of all of these books, I guess. But and so you can buy medical debt for pennies on the dollar. And they asked people to donate when she passed away. And to this day, they've paid off $100 million in medical debt to the point where now Mayor Eric Adams, piece of shit, worst mayor in history, just announced a program without mentioning her because, of course, that they're partnering with that same charity that buys medical debt to alleviate $2 billion worth of New Yorkers' medical debt in the next decade. And so, like, in the smallest way, it's, like, comforting that, like, these stories that I felt, you know, didn't do well enough in public or, like, felt too personal at the time. They had all made her feel a little bit better, but then also, like, to know that it's just a universal feeling when you're sick. Like, you can't predict those things. And we're so grateful. Like, we should be so grateful every day to have air in our lungs and to be able to walk around and to not, you know, have whatever pop up. I think it's just, like, when I look at my book now, I think about, like, her reading it and giving me notes, and I reread the emails, and I'm like, they were just so impactful. So, like, more for me than for anyone else, I love this book.
That's amazing. And the amazing how the meaning of it has changed over time and how threaded within expectations of how it was going to play in the marketplace.
Yes.
And the cover design and all these things was a relationship between you two and words that you didn't even know were going to help her at a time when she needed help.
Or even just, like, yeah, like, really be relatable. And, like, yeah, so, I mean, I feel like I mourn her every single day, and I probably always will. But, like, I feel really lucky that I got to work with her specifically. Like, when I see her roster of authors at Penguin Random House, it was just, like, stacked. And, like, the fact that, you know, I'm the one missing deadlines, and, like, this also came out right before Obama's book did, and, like, they, like, basically stopped the presses on all books. They were like, we're gonna, like, he's gonna be Harry Potter, he's gonna save publishing. Just to be able to, like, put this little thing out into the world still feels really special. But the other point, you know, kind of to the, like, the expectation of it doing so well and being something specific in my life. Like, I'm working on writing it into a pilot because I think it just, it like, in hindsight, it's maybe that's the better way to tell the story, you know, in the Bob Waxberg way. But I also think, like, about, to the expectation point, I guess, or at least how it, like, how it did, and how, you know, things that I love don't necessarily do well. I saw a movie recently. It's called Welcome Home, Roxy Carmichael. It is a Winona Ryder movie. It, no one ever talks about it because it came out right before Edward Scissorhands. And who's the guy in Dumb and Dumber that's not Jim Carrey? I always forget.
Jeff Daniels.
It's Winona Ryder, Jeff Daniels, like, incredible cast, and, like, really specifically about parasocial relationships with this person from a small town named Roxy Carmichael who left. Like, and all they know is, like, she moved to L.A. So is she famous? Is she whatever? But everyone, like, everyone's reason to live is, like, well, I went to high school with Roxy Carmichael. Well, I'm whatever. And Winona Ryder plays a character named Dinky Bassetti, who's, like, kind of, I think she was adopted, and she didn't know who her mom was. So she believes that this Roxy Carmichael is her mom, and the whole movie centers around her coming back to town. And so it's like, it throws everyone into a frenzy because it's like, what would Roxy do? What would her hair look like? Like, and, you know, all of their stories become varying degrees of true or not. And no one knows about it. And I'm like, I rewatch this movie now all the time where I'm like, this movie rules. And so I'm like, that's how I feel about my book. If no one ever reads it again, I will come back to it and it'll mean something different. And I still think it rules.
That's so cool. That's so cool. It means you put some sincere part of yourself into it that lives.
I tried.
Yay. It's no easy task. It took me 2 years to finish two stories for a book proposal.
It's tough.
And I don't even feel good about the stories.
I mean, I don't think anyone ever really feels good about a book that they wrote, is the truth. I mean, maybe someone does. Maybe someone who's like an egotistical person who just thinks like, I'm Michael Jordan and I just slam dunk. But it's like, I think if it at least feels true to you in that moment, that is
in that moment.
I think it is like a good moment in time because I think so much of what I say in here is also just like immediately not the case anymore. Like, things don't just go up.
Right, right.
The internet completely shifted.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe in 2020 forever, like, that was just this real stark moment where it's like, if everything's going to be online, then it's like, well, that's not even a niche anymore. Like, everybody's online.
Yeah.
So I think that, like, I'm glad it came out when it did. I'm glad that I wrote it. I think that I need to live a few more years before I write something that's just, like, about my own life, frankly.
Yeah.
But I do think, like, it was just a great practice in trying to make something and see it to the end. And now I, like, I understand that things can take a long time and never happen, frankly. Like, never come out. Never be something that, like, is seen or, you know, just hasn't been yet. And that's not a reflection on the work. Like,
yeah.
In the same way that debt's not a reflection on you. It's like, things happen or don't.
Yeah, no, I was just talking with Cam about the book Confederacy of Dunces, which the guy killed himself, the writer, sorry. He was unknown, and his mom made it her life's mission to get his book published.
Wow.
And it became this book that anyone who reads it loves. It's very funny, it's absurd, it's special, and you just think, all right, well, how many hundreds and thousands of books are sitting in laptops right now that don't have a dedicated champion of them, you know? And it's like, yeah, but that art still lives. That art lives in a conversation, the one you and I are having right now, anywhere. So yeah, I just really appreciate you coming on here because I feel inspired by what you had to say about all your books and yourself.
Thanks.
And the one you wrote. And I once heard that, like, most people believe their lives would be a good book, right? But the confidence to actually write those stories out and the dedication is unique. And I feel like what you said, I think, is really inspiring to a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, so that's nice to hear.
Glad we got to talk. I'm glad
I got to
hear some of your thoughts. And yeah, I think this was great.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Akilah Hughes.